They fired again and again. And on the fourth barrage, I was already turning the road, and we were pulling away to go for a more secured position. I had reported back that this target was out of range, and I was unable to spot rounds anymore, and I did not see any smoke or any mortars impact. They continued to fire a fifth and sixth barrage into an Afghani village. Members of the scout sniper team were in a hide up in the mountain and had been called down into the village to perform emergency triage on numerous casualties. Later that night, they called me over their tent and they asked me if I was qualified to call for fire. And I told them I was not qualified. However, I was asked and I gave the responses needed to quickly assess the danger and proceed forward with the mission.
Proudly welcomed war resistors with open arms. 26-year-old Kimberly Rivera is one of them. It's been an uphill battle for the former U.S. soldier who faces deportation. Tonight, she's won a reprieve.
This is a slight victory because I don't have to go home tomorrow, so I'm very, very excited. You know, I don't have to be handed over to authorities, so it gives me another day to fight.
It was an 11th-hour ruling by the federal court. Rivera was granted an emergency stay.
But it is only a temporary stay, so it is only for potentially a couple of weeks, at the most, maybe months.
Many people here tonight are signing this petition asking the government to stop the deportation of U.S. war resistors like Kimberly. If she is ordered back to the States, she could likely face jail time and be separated from her family, including her four-month-old daughter. After refusing to serve a second tour in Iraq, Rivera fled to Canada with her family in 2007. If she is ordered back to the U.S., she could face more than a year behind bars.
I was fighting for your liberty. I was fighting for peace. I was fighting to keep my family safe from you and your family. But in reality, I was fighting to destroy everything you know and love. I destroyed the land you live on. I crushed your spirit. In fighting, I kept you silent. In my fighting, I kept you out of sight and out of the way so everything of value could be taken. In the last thought of reality, I find I was becoming something that was not me. In my heart, everything I was fighting for wasn't great enough to give up any life. All of my battles were very true to me. I know from my heart through my change I cannot fight with violent means for peace. My fight for peace is with my pen to share my thoughts without fear of being locked up in a dark place where no one can hear. Canada, I'm here. Can you take the time and the heart to understand what I am now fighting for with words, not a gun? And I signed my name. And I wrote it July 11, 2017. 2008.
Katie, come here.
My family was getting broken. So in order for me to keep it strong, I had to put aside a career. Because at that time, I had to do something more important. Is it the money? Is it the job? Is it the benefits? What, I'm keeping this so I can destroy my family? Or do I want to be humble and live a little lower in level to have my family? Which one is more important to me? So I chose, of course, my family. My loyalty is very strong. My will does not break very easy, but you can only be loyal to one. You know, it's either strangers who don't really give a damn about your family, or your mind, or your feelings. They just say, lock them up because it doesn't matter. And to me, yeah, it matters.
The way that we decided to leave the U.S. wasn't the decision that we made at first. Kimberly and I had sat down and talked about how she felt and how she wasn't okay with what was going on over there. Because the whole time she was over there, she wasn't doing what she was told she was going to be doing. She was basically just in charge of patting people down and treating them like criminals, you know, patting women down and just, you know.
A lot of soldiers gave up a lot of their lives and to be a soldier. They give up their families, their wives, their children. And I couldn't make that same sacrifice. So maybe it makes me smaller. Maybe it makes me stronger. I don't know. All I know is, for me, it's not right. And it was not right.
She couldn't do it. You know, she couldn't. In a situation where she would have to kill someone, she wouldn't be able to do it. And it's not within our morals for, you know, for that to happen. And she wouldn't be able to do it. So we talked and we were going to go back to the base at Fort Carson and tell them, you know, that that's what she had decided and work it out with them.
I was there for 3 months, okay? I didn't go back after my 3 months. We already lost quite a few men in our infantry units. And my unit, the only reason I know is that they were going out and they support soldiers. They're not infantry soldiers. They're just like mechanics and cooks who they put on security positions because they don't have enough infantry men to go out and do the infantry jobs. And that's how I know, because the youngest soldiers in our support company was killed in a roadside bomb. And the road is not in our base. So I know that my company was in there doing the raids and the curfews and the patrols.
Well, I had talked to the recruiter, you know, plenty of times about her being a mom and going to war, and he assured me that her being a woman, that she would be never be sent to a combat zone. Basically feeding me lies from the very beginning, you know, because as soon as she was sent to her base, we found out that right away, basically, not even from her chain of command, we found out through the TV that she was going to be going to Iraq.
2006, we were stationed in downtown Fallujah at the mayor's compound. We had a couple of Marines that were being punished, and one of their punishments was to remove all this paperwork from the top floor of the mayor's compound and bring it down into our dumpsters while in full gear. This took hours for them to do, and I think it might have spanned across days, actually.
Well, after all the paperwork was gone, I finally had a chance to sit down with my interpreter and just ask, you know, what was all that paperwork? Well, come to find out, we destroyed all the birth certificates of the city of Fallujah.
South Africa go down through horrible defeat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They're awful. They stink. The only reason they're in the tournament is because it's in their country.
Everything is setting some flags on our porch.
Cover the New Yorker that
yeah,
year.
They're in the final last time. So
we should.
You know, you never. You can't be sure. But anyway. Yeah, so this is my my fatigue jacket from when I was in the Army. This is my dog tag here, which identifies me, and it states my date of birth and my social security number, and it also states religion, none, no preference. And these, they give you two on a chain. And they are used when you die, if you die in war. One of them goes in your mouth, and one goes between your toes, so that when they put you in the bag, and they take you out of the bag again, they know who you are. Yeah, I should wash the dishes. Oh, God. Well, so when I was drafted, many of the people who were drafted were middle-class guys, who had been to university and so forth. So it wasn't like, in those days, the reason you went to university for many people was to stay out of the military because you got a deferment for as long as you stayed in university. Eventually, by the month, by December, I received orders to, you know, I had completed my training and I received orders to go to Vietnam, and I had a decision to make as to whether I would comply with that order. I was, like all soldiers are given a few weeks to go home before they leave for overseas duty, and I went home, and I consulted with various people, lawyers and so forth, whether there was any way that I could go to this base that I was assigned to in state of Washington and refuse to go and say, okay, I refuse this order, punish me and I'll be court-martialed. And they said, we can't guarantee that. They could just as well put you in handcuffs and put you on a plane and send you to Vietnam anyway. So I decided that it wasn't worth taking that risk. And so I decided to go to Canada. Well, this is my undesirable, discharge is undesirable. So this allowed me to visit the United States. By getting this discharge, I could visit the United States or return there to live if I wanted. But I never decided I didn't want to return to live there. But I did want to be able to visit my family and so on. And the date, 21st of March, 1975. Okay, you know where the place is from here, right?
Back in the 70s, a lot of Vietnam deserters, draft dodgers, used to hang out here and drink and so on. I didn't myself particularly, but it's got a long tradition behind it of war resistors. You know?
Ashley, and this is Wesley, this is William, and my husband Jeremy, and we are the Brockways.
He was sent to Iraq. There he became very distressed. When he came back from Iraq, he tried to get medical help for his mental condition, which was he had been thinking of suicide and found it very difficult to relate to people, and found that it was impossible for him to get that because they wouldn't believe that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome or anything else like that. He has made a refugee claim along with his wife and now two children who have been born in Canada. His wife has a really tough job supporting him and also raising two small boys. He tried very hard to get access to veteran services for his condition, but as I say, they tend to sort of blame a soldier.
I started to go through the process of filing for a medical board. And it ended up being denied because my commanding officer wrote a non-medical assessment and said that my problems weren't affecting my job performance. Like, I was basically the same still. And I was still able to perform all of my duties. And so my medical board was rejected.
This is the combat training in the Marine Corps for the School of Infantry. This says it recognizes that Jeremy, for making sacrifices, it's just a certificate of appreciation. This is a scrapbook that Jeremy's mom started for him. And it starts off when he first told them that he joined the Marines. They had gone out to dinner. And it says it was June of 2005. And this is, I believe, as he was graduating, his parents were able to come and watch them do some different things for the graduation.
For me, the military seemed like a pretty good option. I didn't have any money for school, and the recruiter said that with the military experience, that would actually count towards college credits. And I would have money to go to college afterwards. And it kind of seemed like a good thing to do for the experience and for patriotic duty. Like, defending our freedom is what I was thinking. Like, making a difference.
I understand that out of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, a grand total of one member has a child in the military. This is a very good indication that if you're doing well in American society, if you're part of the elite, you don't send your kids to defend that society. The people who go to defend it are those who are not doing well and are not benefiting as much by that society. And I think that's grossly unfair. And but I think for many poor kids, the idea is, look, this is the only way out. And for me to, you know, to just sort of stay out of the military and work in Walmart and so on. This is what Kim ran into. She was working at Walmart and found that there was just no chance for her to get much above the minimum wage for a long, long time, if ever. And she figured, I got to go back in the Army. So she went back to the Army. And for others, it's the possibility to go to college.
You do what you have to do mostly because the economy is not going good. There's no work. The only work is in the military or in Walmart, maybe. Maybe if you're lucky. And other places like that. And beneficially for a career, if you're needing medical, dental, life insurance, if you're needing any of those things, they have it. So it's very easy for somebody to do that, to think that they're going to get a better life with the problems. Most soldiers don't live past four years. So if they ever think about it, those few years that you have some benefits is not even worth that.
I took my hands off of my weapon altogether and began jumping up and down, waving my hands back and forth, trying to get this car to stop and see me. The car kept coming. And so I raised my weapon, and the car kept coming. I pulled my selector switch off of safe, and the car kept coming. I was applying pressure to my trigger, getting ready to fire on the vehicle. And out of nowhere, a man came off of the side of the road, flagged the car down, and got it to pull over. He walked around to the driver's side door, opened it up, and out popped an 80-year-old woman. Come to find out, this woman was a highly respected figure in the community, and I don't have a clue what would have happened had I opened fire on this woman. I would imagine a riot. If a foreign occupying force came here to the United States, and regardless of what they told us, whether they told us they were here to free us, to liberate us, and to give us democracy, do you not think that every person that owns a shotgun would not come out of the hills and fight for their right to self-determination?
By the time that my unit was deployed to Iraq, the government shifted their focus. They couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction, so they shifted our mission to gaining freedom for the Iraqis. And that was a little disillusioning for me, because I thought that we were there to protect ourselves. And then they just shifted it to something else because they were wrong.
The war affected me personally by taking away, I guess, what I thought our married life would be like, and the way that our family would be, and the things that we would enjoy, and the opportunities we would have. We probably spent maybe a week together after we were married before he had to go back to Camp Lejeune where he was stationed. And I saw him 5 more days before he deployed, and that was it. I became even more depressed because he was gone. Like, the man that I love left, and we were only together such a short time after we were married, and we didn't have that time to bond. And well, I wasn't sure when I would talk to him again. I kind of expected that I wouldn't be able to talk to him at all while he was there. And so I thought I would try and just busy myself with everything. And so I decided to take a college course, and I got 2 jobs, and I tried to spend a lot of time with his family, because then it would make me feel closer to him by being able to spend time with them. And then
it ended up that the job that he had in the military, he could talk on the internet and email back and forth. So I would tell him my problems, but he would never talk about anything. And he was going through a lot that he never told me.
While we were there, I got to be kind of friends with one of the Iraqi policemen. He was in his police truck, and one of the Marines that was assigned to the guard duty shot up his police truck with him still inside. The Marine just lost it. And he ended up being shot in the chest, the policeman. But we couldn't get the medical chopper to come in and pick him up because he was considered low priority because he was Iraqi.
Jeremy having post-traumatic stress and anxiety and everything, it affects me and the children a lot because it isn't like a normal family situation. Oftentimes it's more like I'm a single parent because he doesn't help a whole lot with the kids or help around the house. He usually doesn't go out, so he wouldn't do like shopping or anything like that. Before, I used to provoke him because before I understood that he had post-traumatic stress and what that meant, I was also suffering from depression, and I used to provoke him because I wanted him to hurt me or something, and he never did. It seems like the only times that things happen is when he's alone, is night, and he starts thinking about all of the things that he's experienced and had to be a part of and done himself. So it's always, he's never inflicted any harm on me or the kids or anything like that.
Being in a crowded area was a dangerous place to be. And there's a lot of trauma that I still have a hard time letting go of. Like, with being in a crowded place, like at the shopping mall, my mind doesn't really understand that it's not dangerous there. It's still kind of functioning like it was in Iraq. Like, I start to do things that I would do in that situation. Like, I'll take cover and try to find my gun. It's like my mind is telling me that I need my gun, but I don't have it, so I start to get a little panicked that I'm under attack and I don't have my gun, and my mind hasn't really realized that I'm not there anymore and that it's not dangerous to do those things.
It was only for emergencies, like if he had a panic attack.
Yeah.
That's all that it was for, so, because it was only for emergencies. When Jeremy first came back from Iraq and was diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress, they prescribed him drugs that were very harsh, and he kind of lived in a dream state for a while. He was very angry and irritable. Sometimes he would do things with no recollection of doing them. He's fallen down the stairs while on these drugs, and he didn't know that happened. And after a flashback or during one. Whether he was thinking that he was protecting himself, I'm not sure exactly what happened. He also has tried to commit suicide, and he's also cut his arms to harm himself.
Before I started getting treatment, I couldn't deal with these problems on an emotional level. And so I ended up cutting myself a lot to physicalize the pain, to make it something that I could deal with. But that didn't really help me really deal with the problems. It sort of just lightened the stress for a little while.
For me, I don't like to ride the public transit because a lot of times it's very crowded. And the more crowded it is, the more anxiety I start to feel, like I start to hyperventilate. Once I go past hyperventilation, then sometimes I could just pass out or I start freaking out, and it's not pretty at all. If I have to take the streetcar, I would just wait for however long it takes for it to not be busy. Then I'll get on like the least crowded bus or streetcar or subway, and I'll wait however long I need to. Just what, how I can deal with it.
The subway was so bad for me. I had to travel to work. I worked in a photo place 3 years ago, and I had to travel the subway to get there. For me, I had to take the very last train every time. The very last one, I had to stand my back against the wall so I can see everything all the way to the end of the subway car. Because one time I have a bad dream that one man just came through the doors that connect the trains together. He came through that door that you're not supposed to come through. And he just shoot everybody. And for me, it was a daymare. Meaning I saw this when I was awake, not when I was asleep.
It was a lot worse like a couple years ago. I couldn't even walk the street without feeling like there was somebody up in some window that was open. If the window was open, I'm freaking walking next to buildings and shit. Hey, I still have to let people pass me by when we're walking on the sidewalk. I hate people walking on my heels or right behind me. It's like, if you're gonna take me, just do it. Don't like keep walking behind me, freaking crap. That's the feeling, right?
The thing that really broke her was two things. Like I said, she had a friend, a couple of friends that were Iraqi women that would go to the base every once in a while because they worked there. One of them, her sister, was hurt by the mortar attacks that they kept on attacking. So seeing that happen to, you know, innocent people was something that was affecting her, as well as seeing the kids that would come in there crying all the time, afraid of them. Afraid of the soldiers and afraid of, you know, the whole situation there, just crying and her wanting to hold them but not being able to because, you know, she's a soldier.
The detainees were flexi cuffed by their wrists behind their back. And they're blindfolded. The Marines were screaming at them to get up, and then they tripped them down on their face. They couldn't break their fall because they were tied up. And the Marines were showing the Iraqis pornography, which was strictly taboo.
their religion, and they made this very obvious to us. I saw a Marine take the hat off of an Iraqi. He shoved it down the back of his pants and wiped himself with it, and then tried to feed it to the Iraqi who was blindfolded. And because he was desperate for food, he actually tried to eat it.
Sir, you're the star of the show?
You're goddamn right I am.
What are you guys doing?
Making a movie.
What's the movie about?
Oh, it's about my life.
Can I be in it?
Well, you are in it now.
Since I'm part of your life now.
I guess. Yeah. What are you selling?
Nothing. I'm actually just helping out kids.
Oh, no.
Have you heard
of
our vision?
Yeah, I just don't have any money.
Sir, this is on camera. You don't want to be on camera saying no to World Vision.
Well, I have to.
All right, cool.
Yeah, sorry.
Can you be on camera telling the World Vision guy that the least you'll do for him is call that number and tell him he's doing an awesome job?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome.
Of
thank
course.
You so much, sir. Good luck on the video.
Okay, thank you.
My friend Harry Mai, and he is, when did you buy this restaurant?
About one and a half years.
1.5 years ago, yeah. And before that he worked in the Eaton Center at a restaurant there, and that's where I made friends with him. And then you got married,
yeah.
And you were decided to go with Mary, your wife, to visit your parents in Vietnam, and you said, do I want to go? So you went over there first, and then I came and I met you. We had a very nice time, very nice time. I only got sick once. Sake.
And last year you come back again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Two more times. Yeah. That's why I didn't want to go. I didn't want to kill Vietnamese people.
Yeah.
They never did me any harm.
But so. I don't like in the war. When I were in the high school, when you finish the high school, you have to study in and go to the war. But I say no.
Go to the army.
Go to the army. But then I say, oh, I don't want it. I want to come to Canada, you know, to study and work here. And that's my dream become true.
Well, no doubt there are some people who fit well into a war environment and, you know, psychologically strengthened by it. I would say that those people are very few and far between, although they talk a lot. But the ones that are damaged by it tend to be quiet about it because they don't want to admit that they're weak. They don't want to compromise their self-image as competent. And of course, there's always the problem that they have expressing it.
I was kind of, in my mind, I was kind of a little depressed, you know? And I still needed to remind myself, you know, that God's with me no matter how much darkness I feel like I'm in and I can't get out. The blue is like how much I've been damaged and how my heart was torn up, like as describes you. And the sign, it represents how it binds everything together because it gives us life and energy to live. This one too has a name. It has the Iraqi sun. And this one shows like, it was during the winter, so I made like snowmen, all of us in snowmen, like my husband and me, and the babies. That's how it's supposed to be, like family is supposed to be tight. I can do contact. Yeah, I was trying to find a woman that I spoke with to a group of women for Voice of Women in Canada. The reason that she intrigues me because I know that she was in Iraq the same time I was. And so our stories tell both sides, the soldier and a citizen. And I just love how it comes together. When I first heard talk, it made me cry always, and still every time I always cry. And I always tell her, I'm so sorry, because you know what? I don't know how life is like for them. I know how it felt when I was seeing it, and it hurt the same. But that experience is different.
Stephen Bush and Stephen Harper sent soldiers to fight for democracy. Democracy means obeying the will of Parliament here in Canada. Parliament have said, as the House of Commons have said very clearly, that war resistors should be allowed to stay in Canada. We are proud of them. We want them to be Canadian citizens. Therefore, there should be no deportations of Iraq war resistors if there is democracy in Canada.
I can't go back and see my dad, and my kids have never seen my parents, so my parents have never seen their grandchildren. And as long as we are looking for refugee status, if I leave Canada for any reason, the case is automatically dismissed. So I'm not sure how long it'll take before there's a decision in that, but hopefully it won't be too much longer. And I think that my children can go to the States, and I think that I could go to the States, but I'm not certain about that, because I know that Jeremy would be arrested, but I don't know if they would arrest me for being with him, since he is considered a criminal.
Living like this is pretty hard. It's very depressing. I've got a lot of health problems that I'm working on right now, you know, seeing many doctors for. We don't get to see our families because they're in the United States, you know, and I was brought up as being very close to my family. The longest I was ever away from my family was maybe a week, you know. I'm very close to my mother and my father and my brothers and my sister. So being away from them for so long, not being able to see them not being able to see their grandchildren, is extremely hard. It's depressing. It's, you know, something we shouldn't have to go through just because, you know, we don't have the right, you know, to stand up for our beliefs.
The lawyer can't help me, because if I go back, it's going to be military versus me. My defense, he can only, in the guidelines of the military tribunal, cannot defend for me. Even I have to basically guilt myself to them. Like, I'll probably have to do a plea bargain of some kind when he tells me that 95% of all the cases, the soldiers take a plea, which would mean that the prosecutor, the military prosecutor, would say, well, we'll reduce your amount of time and this and that if you decide not to go public, or if you decide to do this or this, we will give you less time. And it depends on that plea, I guess, what I would do.
She's an Iraq war resistor. She refused to fight in Iraq, to continue to fight in Iraq. And we know that you have the ability to do something to help this family in distress. They are in considerable distress. We know there's an arrest warrant for her for deportation. She will be arrested when she crosses the border, when she's forced out next week. So we're just asking for your intervention, some compassion for this family that is in, and of course the motion.
It's actually Minister of Public Safety deals with removals, not me, but if you want to send me particulars on the case.
Yeah, absolutely, but the humanitarian situation that she's in, she did apply for humanitarian compassionate consideration, and we're just desperate to try and get.
Sorry, Sir, I'm not aware of your particular case because we receive thousands of applications for agency, and they're generally dealt with by department officials. But I will.
Next Wednesday.
Okay. So you send me particulars. I will have my office look into it. I'm afraid I'm late for my next thing. Thank you, Kimberly.
Please don't report this family, Minister.
If we end up having to go back to the States, I'm very concerned because we don't have any money of our own right now. I don't have a job. I have two kids. Jeremy would be in jail, and so I don't know where we would live. We wouldn't have any health care. And I would have to find, like, my kids, they wouldn't have their dad anymore. They would have to go to daycare so I could work. So they wouldn't hardly have me anymore. And I don't know what that would be like for our whole family. I think that it would really stress Jeremy out and just completely destroy him.
My goal is to just be a normal person again. To do the things normal people do, you know, go to the movies on Friday, have a regular job. Take a vacation by the lake. Just stuff like that.
Hello, God. Is he here too?
Yeah, my name is David Solnit. I work with a peace group called Courage to Resist, and we have a bunch of folks from peace and human rights groups, and we've gathered 6,000 signatures in support of Kimberly Rivera. And so we would like to present them.
Wonderful. Okay. Do you want to just step into this room right here, and I can accept it on the other side, or do I have to betray and all that?
Okay. Okay. Awesome.
Well, hello. My name is Richard Sandrell, and I am a Vietnam veteran. During Vietnam, Canada was on the right side. They helped support my brothers and sisters from going over and fighting a war based on lies, as the Iraq War is also. So unfortunately, Canada, I guess, has had a change of government, and things aren't quite the same as they were once was. So I would encourage Canadian citizens, as well as the Canadian government, to reassess the whole thing about war resistors coming to Canada and Canada accepting them. They're killing the civilians, and she's taking a good stand. She's taking the moral and right stand and saying, no, I refuse to go and continue to kill people for lies.
Canada, please let Kimberly Rivera stay.